Session number 7266, Real Six.
General Lloyd, Real Six. General, could you tell me some more about the formation and role and general characteristics of Peter Force?
Well, you must understand, of course, that I was a comparatively junior officer during this period, and what I have to say may not necessarily be the absolute truth. All I can tell you is about my impressions from the point of view of a captain on the general staff. Well, I've already said, I think, that the 12th Division consists basically of three infantry brigades, each of three infantry battalions, the 35th Brigade, the 36th Brigade, and the 37th Brigade, and we had the Queens, the Buffs, and the West Kents composing the infantry battalion. We had no artillery and no sappers and no divisional signals, as far as I remember. We did have a full complement, however, of Army Service Corps. And the OCRASC was Major Ronald Smith, who became a great friend of mine, although we hadn't met before the war. When Peter Force was created, they brought into the 12th Division quite a number of base and lines of communications troops. I remember that the signals element of Peter Force was lines of communication signals. And I think in a previous tape, I told you about some headquarters signals which we captured, we took over on the retreat from Arras. We also had a scratch artillery battery, and being a gunner myself, I was given command of it. This was a scratch unit from start to finish. It consisted of reinforcement gunners taken from the LFC reinforcement unit, and the guns were a few 25-pounders, I think about 8 or 9 of them all told, and a couple of 60-pounders medium artillery, and they came from the base ordnance depot, which was, I think, based in the Forêt de Rouvre, which was south of the Somme, somewhere south of Rouen. I think I also told you that I had command of this battery for about a week or 10 days, I think, all told. And we were put into a defensive position just in front of the Somme on the edge of an airfield where we, in the forward edge of a patch of woodland. Quite an extensive wood, actually, some acres, I suppose, now, in retrospect. And I think I also told you that one of the extraordinary features of this part of the campaign was that no one knew for certain where anybody was, either our own troops or the Germans, and that, roughly speaking, the battery was in action with guns pointing to the north, the east, the west, and the south during this period of 10 days. I think I also told you that the interesting feature of a German attack was that it was invariably preceded by motorcycle troops who looked very what's the word? Frightening, I suppose, is not too big a word to put on it. Dressed in a sort of black leather uniform, and they invariably preceded a small number of tanks, which I suppose would have been a section or at most a squadron. The method of attack was to, for the motorcycles to come forward in advance of the tanks by something like 100 yards or so, according to the terrain. They would deploy when they came under fire. They would bring up the tanks, and the other remarkable feature from then on, of course, was the extraordinary speed with which they were able to bring down what we used to call in the gunners fire for effect. However, the cheering thing on our side was that our 25-pounder was more than a match for any German tank. And, of course, this type of fighting on the very low downs to the north of the Somme was that we were able to take on tanks over open sights, which, as you probably know, is a gunner's dream.
Were you actually able to do that yourself?
Yes, I was. Yes, not actually fire a gun, but take command. In gunner parlance, of course, I had only, I think, about two other officers, gunner officers, at the time, both of them lieutenants. There was a Lieutenant Arrowsmith, I think it was, and a Lieutenant, I think his name was Bourden, B-O-U-R-D-E-N. However, I used to act almost invariably as what we gunners call a gun position officer. At no time did we fire over indirect sights. It was all open sight work, and it was practically all anti-tank work.
So you weren't actually used as conventional artillery at all?
Not conventional artillery, no, not whatever. The best way of describing our role, I think, was an anti-tank battery.
And were you using the 60-pounders in an anti-tank role?
Yes. They, of course, were pretty useless, but on the other hand, we discovered that they were also pretty frightening.
Yeah, I would imagine they'd have a tremendous morale effect.
Oh, tremendous. And one of the things, of course, about a 60-pounder is it's a quite incredible muzzle blast. When a 60-pounder goes off, you know all about it for miles around.
Did 60-pounders ever actually hit a tank?
Not that I remember. But I did see on one occasion a shell from a 25-pounder. It went right through the first tank and burst on the turret of the second tank in line. This was on a causeway. The tanks were on a causeway, and the third tank ran into the second tank, and that one shell put out the whole section of tanks. Very satisfying.
Can I ask you a bit more detail about this scratch battery? You mentioned you had three officers, and presumably...
Well, myself and two.
Yeah. Each one of you was controlling a small group of guns.
That's right.
How did you actually convey your instructions to the detachments operating the guns?
By a megaphone.
So it's shouting through a...
Yes, megaphone. All of it. And usually the tanks were, the guns were in action on the leading edge of the wood, of a wood. That's what we'd been recommended to do, and that in fact was what we found to be the most satisfactory way of operating.
So the best position was just inside the trees?
That's right.
What sort of line of sight did you have from your woods? How far could you see normally?
Oh, well, we used to pick our battery position according to the field of fire, and we always looked for something like 600 yards or that or thereabouts. Not less, I would think.
What was the sort of optimum range for opening fire on advancing enemy vehicles?
Well, I don't think we ever let them get closer than about 500 yards. We would open fire at about... we'd open fire, I suppose, between 500 and 1,000 yards. And because a 25 pound is not all that rapid in traversing, you know. If you have to do a big traverse, you have to move the trail, which is not to be recommended. So one of the factors was to give oneself the maximum time to traverse and get the angle of sight and get the sight onto the tanks or the troops.
When you did open fire, did you open fire individually or did you start off with a volley from the...
No, it was nearly all... Well, the initial order to fire was for... let me see now. We sometimes used a ranging shot, but more often than not. Because with open sights, the rangefinder will give you the range accurately. So there should have been no need for ranging shots. And although don't forget that all our personnel were rusty at work on the guns because they were all base personnel. All reinforcement personnel. So they were all pretty rusty. So you had to make allowances for that. But on the other hand, of course, open sight firing is comparatively simple. And as I say, if you could spot the enemy somewhere about 1,000 yards and engage the enemy when they'd close to about 500 yards, that usually gave enough latitude to pick them up and get them in, well into your sights.
Did you engage other targets as well?
Well, I'm afraid we did. Once or twice we engaged targets which were either civilian. It was not at all easy to distinguish friends from enemies. And, of course, there was also the dilemma that very often... military vehicles had been French military vehicles had been taken over by refugees who, as I explained earlier, were mainly travelling along the roads, but of course when they got these French military vehicles they were taking tracks across country. We certainly engaged those by mistake. I'm not conscious that we ever engaged any German infantry, but on the other hand, we were in the German reconnaissance zone, so we were much more likely, as we did in fact, to encounter motorcycle troops and tanks.
So light mobile reconnaissance groups?
Light mobile reconnaissance units, yes. I remember... things are coming back to mind as I'm talking, of course, naturally. I remember on one occasion we took in a German reconnaissance unit which had half-tracks vehicles. And it was what we would call an armoured car regiment.
Did you lose any guns or men to enemy fire coming in?
Well, we had quite a number of casualties during the 10 days or so. On several occasions, we were attacked by isolated bombers, mainly Stukas. They, of course, as you probably know, operated in front, in the advance, with the advance elements of the German army. And we were bombed once or twice. Of course, dive bombing is quite incredibly frightening, but it's also very inaccurate. And I've no precise figure in mind, but I would say that we lost about, out of a battery strength of about, I suppose the strength of the battery was about 250 personnel all told. We must have lost about 30 or 40 during the 10-day period.
Did these losses have any noticeable effect on the morale of the rest of the soldiers?
Well, the whole business of morale during that time was very, very interesting. This was, of course, the first time that I myself had ever come under fire. And I can't remember ever having any impression of ultimate defeat. We had a curious sense of being invincible as a nation, although, strangely enough, being intensely frightened by the methods employed by the Germans. The most frightening thing of all was this dive bombing. And I think you have to equate the dive bombing with all the evidence of civilian panic, so that the general impression that we had was of a very, very powerful and professional enemy, a very, very demoralized French army, a very, very demoralized French civilian population, but at the same time, our capacity to deal with anything that the Germans could do.
Sounds a very schizophrenic.
Oh, it was. It was very schizophrenic. But I can quite honestly say that from the moment we heard the very first shots being fired, right back to the time we were evacuated to England, and right into the September of that year, which was the Battle of Britain, was it not? At no time did we have, any of us, have any conception that we were going to surrender.
How were the casualties in the battery dealt with when they occurred?
Oh, no, that's, I haven't thought about that for ages. I don't know. I can't tell you how they were eventually evacuated, but that they were evacuated, of that I'm certain. What we did was to do the best we possibly could. We had some medical personnel. We took over houses in the areas in which we were operating and evacuated the wounded into these houses. The chap who did the evacuating was Major Smith, was his Army Service Corps unit.
So it wasn't an ambulance unit?
No, it wasn't an ambulance unit. He was an expert in whipping up vehicles of all sorts from various, I think, base depots, Army Service Corps depots and so on. And he certainly whipped up a couple of ambulances, I remember. But this wasn't only serving us, of course. It was serving the other units in Peterforce as well. We must have had an organisation in Peterforce, I'm quite sure of that. But I know nothing in detail of its organisation.
Now, in Peterforce, Who actually gave you your orders? How did they come down the line from the...
Well, we had a divisional staff. There was General Peter himself. There was a GSO1 ops. There was a GSO2 ops. He was... I remember he got the MC for delivering a message, I think, to de Gaulle, oddly enough. I think de Gaulle commanded a light motorised division, didn't he?
He had a force with... Certainly had armoured vehicles in his force. It's probably a light armoured division.
Light armoured division, I think. Yes, that's right. And... well, I've forgotten his name. I'll probably remember before you go. And we had an AA and QMG in those days, you know, also a lieutenant colonel. So the divisional staff was a lieutenant colonel on the ops side and a lieutenant colonel on the administrative side. I received my orders from the ops side of the division.
And they came down through the scratch
straight,
signals.
Straight from division.
How were your orders actually transmitted? Did they mainly come through the radio, or were they by personal contact?
Motorcycle, dispatch rider. Almost invariably.
Did you find during this phase, when presumably you were moving a bit, that the radios didn't work or were difficult to... Yes.
Well, it was partly that, and it was partly also, of course, that we were so badly equipped. And I think you might use the term irregularly equipped. That is to say, headquarters had one type of radio set, the exact description of which I've now forgotten, and we in the units had another type of set, and so on. In other words, the whole system was so... irregular and uncoordinated. It was a question of supply and, you know, supply. No supply.
Now, you mentioned that you normally took position on the forward edge of a wood.
Mm.
When you got into such a position, did you dig in?
Partly. Very, very little, though. The invariable practice was to dig slip trenches for personnel purposes. But the weapons were left outside, the trenches, that is, so as to be able to be rapidly manoeuvred. A, for sighting purposes, and B, of course, for making a quick getaway. The vehicles, by the way, were lorried vehicle.
Were they Scammels?
That's right, Scammels with, what, 8 wheels, I think.
Scammel tractors, I think.
Scammel tractors, yes, that's right. Or Scammel, wait a minute. I've forgotten. They had a special title, Scammel something or other. Anyway, they were 8-wheeled and really quite satisfactory vehicles, as a matter of fact. Very, very good. Traction was good. And, of course, we had the advantage of a most marvellous summer, so we never had any problem by being bogged down. That used to be the great problem in training in the United Kingdom, before we went bogging down, but not in France.
Have you any idea of how many different positions you occupied in that 10 days?
Oh. Must have been... There must have been 5 or 6 different locations. I have the impression it was about every other day that we were able to move. I'm not clear at this stage what our exact role was, and I would guess that nobody really knew. That's what I would guess, but I can't remember having been given ever any comprehensive orders. I was told to move from A to B and do this, that and the other, but it was almost invariably in an anti-tank role. And as I've told you, the targets that we took on in the jargon of the day, were targets of opportunity.
How much discretion did you have in selecting a position? How specifically
did
they...
Oh, almost complete discretion. reconnaissance, of course, was practically non-existent. So that the reconnaissance, so-called, was usually done from the map. And incidentally, we had quite good maps, I remember. In fact, very good indeed.
Were they French maps or British ones?
French maps. French maps.
So if I can roughly summarise, you would be told to cover a certain area of ground against an armoured advance.
That's right.
Look at the map to see which piece of wood looks as though it might give you a good, clear field of fire.
That's right.
Go there, do a quick visual reconnaissance on the ground.
Yes.
And then, presumably, the guns would arrive shortly after.
That's right. And then we would take up position. Yeah. We would zero in by rangefinder and map. That we did that invariably because that was only prudent. And after that, of course, we would relax and feed, post sentries, and so on. Usual routine.
How far, how wide, how much distance did you normally have between the actual guns? How far apart were they?
Well, it would vary, but I would think, say an average of about 20 or 30 yards. All governed by the fact that they had to be within voice range so that they could be commanded from one gun position.
Now, you mentioned putting out sentries once you'd got the guns in place. Where would the sentries go? Would they be forward of the
on
guns?
On the forward edge of the wood, as a rule.
So they'd be observation?
On observation, and... my instructions were to keep mobile and to patrol irregularly.
So you had to do your own local security.
That's right, local security. That was very important because I don't know, there's nothing sinister about it, but of course, don't forget the whole, all these wooded areas were littered with refugees.
So you have to clear those out of the way.
You've got to clear those out of the way, A, for their own safety, and B, because, of course, we'd been warned about saboteurs. And, in fact, we'd had some experience of saboteurs, mingling with the refugees.
What had these particular saboteurs done?
Mainly set off explosive charges here and there. Mainly in the villages and on the routes where the refugees went.